Cato now runs exactly the same argument all over again with respect to law. So, on the one hand, it sounds like good liberalism, right? On the one hand, on the other hand. On the one hand, the very idea of appearances obeying laws, if such laws are not going to be mere repetitions of those appearances, requires what I call conceptual assent. That is, that we get insights into the meaning of diverse phenomena by seeing how things that look different turn out, if we go up another level, to be obeying the same law. That there's a law at the level of appearances, and then there's an overarching law. And of course, the example that he uses here, the example that blew everybody's mind, which I regard as the beginning of modernity, is Newton's unification of the laws of terrestrial mechanics and the laws of celestial mechanics under one single set of laws of motion and gravity, the Lambert square law. And Hegel therefore imagines, and that just looks right. You can understand why that would be a form of insight. And Hegel then goes on to argue that we must imagine this conceptual ascent happening to the point at which there is only one law, or if not only one law, even just the idea of lawfulness itself. And at this moment, he says, we might get queasy and be puzzled about how there can be just one law that is the truth of everything. That is, it seems as if we've again lost the very determinacy, right? Just to state, the inverse square law doesn't seem like you're going to get an account of everything. Now, said like this, this has got to be the worst argument in the entire chapter. It really is a bad argument. And it's a bad argument because there really is something deep about conceptual assent. It is a form of insight. And therefore, he seems not here to be taking account of what's going on in systemization and building up deductive systems and the like. So what is he thinking about here? What's underlying what looks like just a bad argument? Well, I take it that what Hegel is driving at is that when we get to the highest level of unity, when we get to the idea of lawfulness itself, first, we seem to be utterly cut off from the empirical world. But we're cut off from the empirical world in a particular way, okay? Namely, and I take it this is what he's hinting at, that the very idea of lawfulness is not something we can read into the phenomena, but rather it's something that we must itself stipulate as a form of understanding. That is what he's assuming. Just to do something with your blank books, is that the person who thought hardest about this was obviously Kant, and Kant tried to demonstrate in the second analogy that the principle of cause and effect is not a given, not a structure of the universe, but a form of understanding. So what Hegel's doing here is suggesting that when we look at the notion of one law, we actually have a certain moment of opacity, in the sense that we have a kind of necessity which we don't understand. And we don't understand it because we're treating it as given. Right? So we're treating the notion of law as a given, and therefore it suddenly is emptied of content. While again, conversely, when we look at the many laws, we just get again a mere repetition of appearances. So what he's thinking here is that the debate, I think this is the thought that he's thinking, that the debate between realism and empiricism over law is actually a debate which asks the question, is truth analytic or synthetic? And of course, you might say that the naive idea of science, those of you who read the first chapter of Dialectic Enlightenment, the naive idea of science is to make the whole world nothing but an analytic judgment, as if everything should follow from one transparent idea. And of course, it was Leibniz's actual project. Right? Let us remember, Leibniz actually did think the universe was nothing but an analytic judgment. Scary. And then conversely, that everything is synthetic. And that we've got now content that simply repeats the world and structure that simply is empty. And we don't know how to put these two sides together. So the one law, many law, as I hear Hegel struggling with it, is not working because at the extreme, both sides are unusable. I think that's what he's supposing. Now, it is this situation that brings us to the question of the inverted world. And I wrote here in my notes, ugh. Okay. Now remember my orienting question. Namely, what kind of difficulty or failure in consciousness is going to force consciousness to change its fundamental stance towards the world? That is, to change the direction of the arrow. So what we're talking about is not just changing a particular thought, because I've tried to argue that the difference between knowledge and action is one of fundamental stance. And we're asking what kind of failure is going to force consciousness to alter its stance, which is to say to give up, and let's be clear what we're asking, to give up the idea that the differences the constitutive differences we find in reality are determined by reality. That reality gives us not just divides itself up into cups and saucers, but into substances, causal events, and the like, things with causes, all that. Has to give up that idea and has to adopt the idea that the kinds of differences in reality that matter, and hence the kinds of unities and differences that matter, must come from consciousness. That is, we're going to try to force consciousness to itself make the Copernican turn. And thus far, all we have seen are higher level failures of the kind that beset perception, with two provisos. First, there is now the demand that identity and difference be somehow internally related to one another. The for itself, force, the in itself of force, is its for another. And secondly, we have begun to suppose that the identity as the ground of difference derives from an object that is thought-like, kind of ideal. It's kind of interesting when you think about Plato, why Plato chose ideas to be the metaphysical reality. And the answer is because they're like thoughts. They're like the very things we think with. Right? So he's thinking that what's deep about the structure of reality is the idea of reality, but he just postulated it up there. Okay, now Hegel's first mention of the idea of an inverted world is announced as the consequence of the positing of a second supersensible world. Paragraph 157. This second supersensible world is in this way the inverted world, and moreover, since one aspect is already present in the first supersensible world, the inversion of the first. With this, the inner world is completed as appearance. For the first supersensible world was only the immediate raising of the perceived world into the universal element. That's the move we've been looking at all along. It had its necessary counterpart in this perceived world, which still retained for itself the principle of change and alteration. That's the empiricist comeback. The first kingdom of laws lacked that principle. That is, the inner world lacked the idea of change in itself, but obtains it as an inverted world. Clear as mud. Now, in fact, if I just read that coherently, this is a version of the same dialectic we've been using throughout. That is, throughout we have been seeing that the truth of the appearance is really what does not appear, hence inverted, and conversely, the actuality of the supersensible or force or law is inverted, that is, the appearances. Hence, the truth of the sensuous is the supersensuous, and the truth of the supersensuous is the sensuous, and each is an inversion of the other. Pippin nicely states this on page 137, where he says, to the extent that such realities and such legislation are empirically independent, they simply invert the sensible world into something else and do not explain it. The classic case, he says, is Aristotle's critique of Plato.
Right? Aristotle simply asks, what do you gain by saying the universal is up there rather than in the thing itself?
There's no explanatory force there. To the extent that they are not independent, to the extent that the empirical manifold is the sole criterion of knowledge, the sensible world inverts itself, is unintelligible without the supersensible world, already caught on the first horn of the dilemma. Now, if this is right, and I just want to step back for a second before I go forward. If this is right, then the idea of inversion or perversion, either will do here, is not a new moment. But rather, it is making explicit the fundamental gesture that consciousness has been rehearsing at every single step along the way. All along, consciousness had suffered inversion, beginning with sense certainty. So we discover the truth of sense certainty, it's this here now, was the universal, the very opposite, the inverse of what it claimed. And hence, it said the opposite of what it intended. The truth was inverted on it. Or, the structure of failure operated inversion, namely, inverting the thing from the many to the one. So the one, right? The many requires the one, the many presupposes the one, and the one presupposes the many. So each turns out to be an inversion of the other. That's the structure of perception. And here, we've been looking at a shuffling back and forth between an empty supersensible unity and an indeterminate sensible many. Now, if this is right, if I'm right that the notion of inversion is actually the structure of consciousness's movement at every stage, then the whole structure of consciousness is nothing but a series of inversions. And if it's true that the entire movement of consciousness is nothing but a series of inversions, then consciousness can only progress if it inverts its inversions. That is, it must make a turn out of its inversions and do what's going to count as, or ask itself the question, what will count as inverting the method of inversions? Roughly, the thought here is that consciousness must come to recognize that all the different ways that have arisen for accounting for reality, namely accounting for it as the this, as the one of the many, as forces, as laws, all these different ways of seeing reality have come from it. And hence, that what has looked to be like changes in the world have not been changes in the world, but changes in our comprehension or the way in which we take the world. Okay, saying it like that is too quick and doesn't quite work, but it's only a little false. So now let's see if I can make the thought even a little bit deeper. Let us look at the text. God help us. First, the opening of paragraph 156. Thus, the change is not yet a change of the thing itself, but rather presents itself as pure change by the very fact that the content of the moments of change remain the same. But since the notion qua notion of the understanding is the same as the inner being of things, this change becomes for the understanding the law of the inner world. The understanding thus learns. First time we've seen the word learn something here. So something is happening here, even though this looks very dark and mysterious. Hegel thinks he's saying something here, that something's happening to the understanding. The understanding thus learns. What does it learn? It learns that it is a law of appearance itself, that differences arise which are no differences, or that what is self-same repels itself from itself, and similarly that the differences are only such as are in reality no differences and which cancel themselves. In other words, what is not self-same is self-attractive. Mud again. Now, something is going on here that is an insight, there is a learning, and there is a mistake here. And hence, that's what structures Hegel's argument, that this is a moment of insight error, insight blindness. So, what is it? Well, there is a positing here of a second law and a second supersensible world, since understanding now gives the law of the inner world. So a second law now arises in which what was formerly characteristic of the law of appearances, and said to lay outside the inner world, finds itself in the region of the inner world. That is, consciousness has come to the thought that it kept wanting to put stability here, change here, unity here, many here. And therefore, it kept the two worlds separate. And that, because of that separateness, it had what we saw as the problem of shuffling. So now it's saying that we must, as it were, put both elements in the same inner world. So what understanding now understands, what it's learned, is that the one and the many, appearance and reality, changing and unchanging, identity and difference, must all belong to one domain. That the problem was the separation of domains. So he talks about the problem as a different sustaining element. So we can only get by this problem by making sure it's all in one domain. No longer a two-world, a two-tier view. But somehow we must be talking about the structure of one domain. And this domain is now identified as the inner of things. So both elements, again, the one and the many, change and unchange, all belong to one domain, and it's the way it's articulated. Now, the confusion that arises here arises because when this second supersensible world appears, it appears as just another inversion, as just another movement in the shuffling we've been looking at, and not, I'm suggesting, an inversion of inversion, so I have to separate, so just another inversion versus an inversion of inversion. That's what I have to distinguish. But the point here is, because it appears as just another inversion, it appears absurdly. And it appears absurdly, to say it appears absurdly is to say that it appears in all the crazy ways that the paragraphs following paragraph 157 talk about. Roughly, and this is how I understand what Hegel is doing here. Understanding, having grasped the idea that identity and difference belong to one integral reality, that's the insight, presumes that if that's the case, then anything must be capable of turning into its opposite. Since that's what the structure has been, things turning into their opposite. So if we push, so if what's held them apart is thinking they're in two domains, but if we now put them all in one domain, then we can say anything can turn into opposite. So north can become south, sweet can become sour, and we get all these crazy stories that Hegel tells. What on earth are you talking about? Here's my guess. I think he's saying that at this point, the understanding has gone too far, and that it has appropriated the idea of identity and difference solely to itself. Solely to itself. And left the actuality or the world wholly outside. Now, the consequence of this is that it makes every difference a mere difference. Or, as we now say it would be postmodern, a diacritical difference. So, this idea of the inverted world is actually bad. Saussurean difference. That is, this is really about the arbitrariness of the sign. And it's saying that if you assume that identity and difference all come from a single domain in which has no content, then anything can count as the opposite of anything else, or remember, you know, the laughter act, you know, the two bathrooms with different pictures, and you, right? Call Matt, it doesn't matter just as long as they're different. So they've lost any content. So the fact of difference or opposition comes to dominate the content and hence becomes groundless, hence becomes arbitrary. Hegel's thought, and I don't know how else to read this idea. I just don't know any other way of doing it. But saying that difference becomes mere difference. And if it becomes mere difference, then anything can be. If we're granting that there's a necessity for marking differences, that's an insight, right? But if we say it's arbitrary, then anything can turn into the opposite of itself,
since it's made, given its position just by being marked as the opposite. So if it's the opposite, then the opposite can be the opposite of it. So north can become south, sweet can become south.
And that's plainly crazy, which is equally what's plainly crazy about the arbitrariness of the sign. It makes no sense. Now, Hegel's thought. You didn't think I was going to go here, did you? You didn't see this one coming. I didn't see it coming. But I don't know how else to read this possibility of inversion as the notion of difference being affirmed but without content. That's clearly the thought. So Hegel's thought here must be that the movement from one to many, from identity to difference, must be a true self-movement of the world, not a positing, that's the dangerous Fichtean word, of unity behind difference, or arbitrarily marking differences, but a comprehending of the movement of reality as self-differing, where the comprehension of reality as self-differing is not different from reality as a whole. The comprehension of reality as self-differing is actually just the structure of reality itself. But you can't separate the reality from its comprehension. So, in paragraph 158, Hegel illustrates this idea, now we'll have to see if this works out in content, by talking about crime, law, and punishment. In which each could say the opposite. So let's look at the passage, paragraph 158. In another sphere, in the middle of the paragraph. Now, you know, when I wrote this at 3, now it's 4:30 in the morning, so it's getting tougher for me to unwind this. In another sphere, revenge on an enemy is, according to the immediate law, the supreme satisfaction of the injured individuality. So, immediately, at the level of appearances, revenge is the spontaneous response to injury. And Hegel just always assumes, by the way, that this is the case. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Someone kills, you kill back. This law, this very law, however, which bids me to confront him as himself, a person who does not treat me as such, who has injured me, and in fact bids me destroy him as an individuality, this law is turned around by the principle of the other world into its opposite. The reinstatement of myself as a person through the self-destruction of the alien individuality is turned into self-destruction. So the problem with revenge is, what I mean by revenging myself and killing the other is to have rectified the past. But all that happens is, of course, that I've set myself up to be killed in return. So the only way I can act on the law of revenge, which is the given law of appearance, is to be destroyed. Call that the empiricism of injury. That's Hegel's assumption here. Step two. Now we're going to get a kind of realism of injury. If now this inversion, which finds expression in the punishment of crime, is made into law. Now we're moving behind, right? So now we're moving to realism. we're taking that, the idea that if there's a killing, there must be a law which says he who kills, she who kills, is punished. It, too, is the law of one world which is confronted by an inverted, supersensible world where what is despised in the former is honored, and what is in the former is honored, meets with contempt. The punishment, which under the law of the first world disgraces and destroys a man, is transformed in its inverted world into pardon, which preserves his essential being and brings him his honor. What is Hegel talking about here? Anyone? By the way, he thought you should have laughed. So take it that he was making a joke. Okay. My wife often says I often laugh alone. What's the joke here? Who is he making fun of? Where is the criminal who trespasses honored? Someone whispered it. Christianity, thank you. So Christianity is just the inversion of the other structure. So if you've killed and you're a sinner, then you're going to be the first one to get into heaven. You know, we love the sinner's best. That's why, you know, George Bush loves, what's his name, who chases little boys around. That's what he said. He's a sinner, and everyone's a sinner, right? So the point here is that he doesn't take Christianity seriously because it simply is an inversion. But if it's just an inversion, then equally you can just do the same in another way, right? What looks like honor in one world is awful in another world. What's awful here is honored in, you know. So, you know, he who is last shall be first. I mean. Okay. Well, what's going to stop that movement? Paragraph 159. And it's 2/3 the way down page 98. The actual crime, however, has its intention and is in itself a possibility in the intention of such, but not in a good intention, for the truth of intention is only in the act itself. By the way, that's a Hegelian principle. That's an anti-Kantian Hegelian principle. The truth of intention is the act itself. We don't give a damn for Hegelians about intention. We're going to spend a lot of time on that. Don't worry about it now. But Hegel takes that to be absolutely essential. Intentions are like, you know, a furry platonic background to action. Hegel's interested in action. For the truth of intention is only in the act itself, but the crime, as regards its content, has its reflection into self or its inversion in the actual punishment. That is, notice the word he chooses. That is the reconciliation. Reconciliation, where have we been? No one's talked about reconciliation before. But suddenly we're reconciling something with something else. We're bringing two things together that have been held apart and finding in them an internal relationship. And this whole book is going to be about reconciliation. Going to be the structure. Instead of truth, we're going to have reconciliation. Whatever that means. No idea. That is the reconciliation of the law with the actuality opposed to it in the crime. Punishment is the reconciliation of the law with. Finally, the actual punishment has its inverted actuality present in it in such a way that the punishment is an actualization of the law, known as actualization, potential actualizing itself, whereby the activity exercised by the law as punishment suspends itself, and from being active, the law becomes again quiescent and is vindicated, and the conflict of individual with it, and of it with individuality, is extinguished. Pretty okay, but this is actually pointing towards Hegel's own odd theory of punishment. And Hegel's odd theory of punishment has the following character, and it's this. Hegel says, you cannot actually believe that a law is a law if you do not equally agree to punish the transgression of the law. And the reason for that is because what makes us think that a law counts as a law if people break it and we do nothing? Right? So, if there's a law and everyone breaks it all the time, in what sense is it a law? So the actuality of the law itself, only reveals itself as actual in the act that transgresses it, and our further punishment of that crime. So notice now the law itself is now differing from itself. The law is not up here and the other stuff down here. The law is articulating its own internal meaning, right? By saying that a transgression of the law will bring about a punishment, and the punishment will, and now Hegel says something really shocking, especially for someone who's worked in prisons, that punishment is something that the criminal deserves or merits as a person. And you might say, that sounds absurd. But it's actually what we do think. And the reason I know we think it is because if we think someone is not free or not a person, we don't punish them. If we think they're mad or underage or all the extenuating circumstances, so punishment is something that only persons truly merit, deserve as persons, and hence what looks like the opposite law is actually a way of reconciling, bringing that individual back into accord with the law, and therefore reinstating the law as the structure of that relationship. Now, that's a theory. And it was a theory of law and punishment that not everyone likes, but we're interested in the metaphysics of that theory. And the metaphysics of that theory is that this entire movement, everything that happens, is both the law differing from itself. What could be more opposite than law than transgression? What could be more awful than punishment? But each of these things turn out to be moments of the law articulating itself and reinstating it, he says, its quiet non-stability. So this is the idea of an identity differing from itself. The law says don't kill. Killing happens. But in the movement, the identity of the law is attained. So the identity of the law only occurs through the very things that are different from it and oppose it. And therefore make the law the law. The whole cycle. Now this is where Hegel is going. So before I turn to paragraph 160, we stop there. That's our concrete illustration. And we got a model of the difference between two worlds and one world. That's what we're trying to get. We're trying to see that the idea of one and many, identity and difference, does not require a two-tiered structure, but an idea of a self-moving actuality sustaining itself through its various moments, by which it becomes the in itself it already was. So, 160 then. Yeah?
Somebody! I mean, obviously, it seems to be echoing a lot of what we talked about, the sort of the causality of pain. I mean, is this any attempt to continue what you've got?
It's a little bit. We haven't got quite a causality of fate structured yet. This is actually a very formal theory of punishment, which says that there is something right about retributive theories of punishment. People may be Kant and Hegel, those old German softies, lo and behold, believe in retributive theories of punishment. But they try, at least the line that Hegel adopts, and I think the line I just gave you is a fair summation of the philosophy of right, more or less. Looking at Rossio, she knows that text better than I do. Hoping somebody does. We haven't got yet that kind of structure. So there's here no forgiveness, none of that kind of stuff yet. We won't get to that till later. Yeah.
Is this predisposition such a law and transgression of law to reinstate the law in the early theological writings? The part where he stated that laws are composed of opposing realities, is that basically how far the law and transgression of the opposing realities?
Yeah, he's using a slightly more naive conception here. He's not now, because there he's actually worried about law as the opposite of reality. Here he's looking at the whole structure of law, transgression, punishment, as the way in which, after all, it's the way in which the criminal gets brought back into the community as one of us. Again, we do think that. The criminal has done his time. That is, the slate's clean. The law is where it is, and the individual is no longer a transgressor, but is now, again, one of us. So all this hurly-burly, everything starts back to where it was. That's what he's interested in here. So what I'm suggesting for the moment is forget about the spirit of Christianity and its faith. We're just confusing on this passage. I see why you're thinking it. And I have in my margins here, spirit of Christianity. And now I've covered the whole of, I was wrong. I mean, same temptation, but I think what I'm doing now is what he's actually thinking.
Well, since natural laws can't be transgressed, is that a problem?
He's not taking them as natural laws, he's taking them as positive.
The scientific.
No, he's going to take natural laws as not natural. That's why this case is easier. That's why it's interesting when you discuss this. It's hard to see how the grip is going to get there in those other cases. So. So I'm using this as the model of self-differing reality. And I'll explain how we get back to the question of nature later.
Oh, why say that? That's interesting. Why say that?
Just this idea of the sort of this necessary other that has to sort of re-establish boundaries of the law. I mean, am I wrong in sort of seeing not similarly?
No. I think one of the things that Hegel thinks, that Freud thinks, that there is no law without the transgression of law. Yes, indeed. So there has to be a moment of abjection as a condition of identity. But it's also to say, here much more naively, no identity except from what opposes that identity. As a condition of that identity itself. So yeah, there is something of that. There's something of this is Beardsworth's reading of Kristeva, right? She has that Hegelian way of reading the abject, exactly. Yeah. That's nice. You two are looking, asking, you have a joint question, or? Okay, 160. From the idea, then, of inversion, which constitutes the essential nature of one aspect of a supersensible world, we must eliminate the sensuous idea of fixing the differences in a different sustaining element. There's no structural divide between the one and the many. There's no divided line. There's no noumena-phenomena difference. All those ways of trying to fix the difference, right, actually is the cause of the series of inversion. So we have to get rid of the idea of what he calls the different sustaining element. And once we do that, he says, then this absolute notion of the difference must be represented and understood purely as inner difference. That is, something can only be different from itself, or is, to use Hegel's language, self-othering, or again, Hegel's language, a repulsion of the self-same as self-same, from itself, and likeness of the unlike is unlike. But all of this now can be understood as this model of the law achieving its status as law by what differs, breaks from it, transgresses it, and then must be reconciled back with it in order for it to be itself. Right? So it needs its opposite, not as another world, but as its own internal corollary. So no identity without difference, and the difference is always the difference of an identity constituted by that difference. Skip down three or four sentences, but just because I have the opposites here in and for itself, it is the opposite of itself, or it has the other immediately present in it. So the other is not absolutely other. If it was absolutely other, then we're back in the world of inversion. There can't be absolute otherness. And we're going to argue about this all semester long. Let's wait and argue about it in say, the Master-Slave. But Hegel denies the strong version of absolute otherness. He says it just generates the logic of inversion. And I know, for all sorts of reasons, that's a contestable idea. But in this case, the other is object. The identity is the self, so we're talking about subject-object dualism. We're trying to overcome subject-object dualism. That's what's at stake here. So he says, thus the supersensible world, which is the inverted world, has at the same time overarched the other world
and has it within it. It is for itself the inverted world, i.e. the inversion of itself. This is the inversion of the inversion, I promise. It is itself and its opposite in one unity. Only thus is it difference as inner difference, or difference in its own self, or difference as an infinity. What these awkward locutions are pressing is the thought that, first, consciousness is not going to find anything outside itself to articulate or ground the relation of identity and difference. And hence, second, that the structure of identity and difference is going to be a self-differing of consciousness itself, or what is the same, consciousness's act of self-determining will become the source or ground for distinguishing and holding together the perceptual manifold. The idea of infinity is for Hegel the same as the idea of necessary self-determination, freedom, because he is contending that nothing outside consciousness can determine the categorical forms of experience. Nothing outside consciousness can determine the categorical forms of experience. Hence, possible knowledge claims cannot be measured against the standard of, now take a list, say, now whatever you want to be the outside. So the non-inferentially warranted given, the apprehension of universals, sense properties, the intellection of a nonsensible ground, or reliance on law. Those all might be things you want to measure your knowledge against. But you can't, right? You can't, right? That's what we've seen to be impossible. So the possibility of consciousnesses, autonomous self-determination, can now only be measured against itself. Consciousness has become self-conscious. Or that's the Copernican turn. That's it. You've made it. You've done it all by yourself. Right? That's what you have accepted in accepting this move. Now, this seems weaker and disappointing compared to Kant. And I want to puzzle that thought out for the next 15 minutes. Why this movement of Hegel seems, having struggled so hard to get here, seems so flat. And it does seem flat. And I want to suggest its flatness is going to be the source of future depth. How am I going to do that? Let's go back to page A109. Let's go back to Kant and see what he does at this moment in the argument. And then we'll see what Hegel does. And we'll see if we can then see why we're going one way rather than another. This is that handout you already have. Oh, you've already, there you go. So, just picking up where I left off last time. Remember, the transcendental object equals X.
theories, Lockean ideas, which we've now seen to be force and law and all these other notions. So Kant says the pure concept of the transcendental object X, transcendental object, which in reality, throughout all our knowledge, is always one and the same. So the function of the transcendental object equals X is what remains the same throughout all reality, and it is what can alone confer upon all our empirical concepts in general relation to an object, that is, objective reality. This concept cannot contain any determinate intuition. It's not another perceptual given, because it's what Anker's thing shows that they're parts of reality, and therefore refers only, and now he absolutely does the Copernican term right before our eyes, therefore refers only to the unity which must be met with in any manifold of knowledge which stands in relation to an object. So it refers only to the unity. Well, what unity? The relation, so far it could be Locke, right? It could be substance I know not what, it could be law, it could be the good in Plato, it could be any of those things, but what does he say it is? The relation is nothing but the necessary unity of consciousness. And therefore also the synthesis of the manifold through the common function of the mind, which combines it in one representation. So what looked like to be, so this is, my interpretation of Kant actually says that the transcendental picture is a transcendental reinterpretation of Locke's new way of ideas. That's, I think, exactly what's going on here. He's reinterpreting Locke, saying, no, it's not substance that grounds reality, it's consciousness that grounds the unity of the object. Now, this claim, consciousness does it, transcendentally unity of that perception, brings us back to paragraph 163, which is where we ended last week, and where it looks like we're going to end this week. So it's nice to know that in 2.5 hours of lecturing, I've gone nowhere. Let's see if we make a little progress. I take it, I'm not going to reread the paragraph, I take it that Hegel is here, as he has been all along, in the previous paragraph with a great deal of huffing and puffing about the self-identical being self-sundering, trying to explain what this new idea of infinity amounts to. And if you remember last week, we read the overblown and somewhat embarrassing passage about explanation providing so much self-satisfaction because in it consciousness is enjoying only itself. Now the reason Hegel takes us here is not only the idea that understanding the world through forms, here explanation, that are as anthropocentric as could be, it's not just that. It is the introduction of the notion of satisfaction that is meant to be pressing the argument forward. The truth, right, of consciousness is it can't get no satisfaction, right? So the whole thing is just a rock song. If there is satisfaction, and here's what consciousness lacks, if there is satisfaction, then there is a desire that is being satisfied. Why is that important? I think it's at just this point that Hegel is going beyond Kant. Kant immediately assumes that the discovery of the forms for integrating the perceptual manifold are simply going to be necessary conditions for the possibility of self-consciousness. And this presupposes all of Kant's kind of theory about forms of intuition and inner time consciousness and the like. Now, Hegel assumes that assessing the terms through which we evaluate what concepts or categories we need in order to comprehend the world must answer to what we want from those forms or categories. So, while Hegel agrees with Kant that the link between the non-sensible and the sensible, between pure concepts and the sensory manifold, is supplied by consciousness itself, his claim is we cannot make sense of that activity of consciousness directly, as if it were an immediate question. Well, what would the question be? Kant's question seems to be, how are representations of the world possible? But if that's Kant's question, then that's a very bad question that we opened up in the introduction that said it was the fear of truth. So that's the very question that denies knowing. Hence, in order to circumvent Kant, Hegel presses the Copernican term, that is, the announcement of infinity, but does so in a manner that presses consciousness outside the idea of a bare representational knowing of the world. That is, Kantianism is still a representational account of knowing, even though, of course, it requires activity. And the way Hegel gets beyond the representational account of knowing is to press the thought that the self-determining activity of knowing is really, I don't know how to do this except by speaking loudly, activity! I mean, it's really action. It's action in the real sense and not in some ersatz sense. It's not action in the form of knowing, it's really a form of action. So the thought here is that knowing must itself be framed as a component of the life of beings who are essentially agents. Now, you're going to say to me, wait a minute, this is not news. Kant and Fichte say as much, don't they? Isn't that what's implied by the Copernican term? Isn't that what's implied by their idea of spontaneity and synthesis and the like? Hegel wants to argue that what kept or keeps Kant and Fichte pigeonholed is they do not actually believe what they say, since they argue as if we are still grounded in the world by our representations of the world. That is, they're still taking it that the fundamental relationship between subject and object is a representational knowing. That is, they express or press the case of agency, and they do. Both of them talk about knowing as a form of agency. And then they withdraw that view at the same time by making the representational relationship to the world the ground of our relationship to the world. So they say we're agents, and yet they say it's just representations. Hence, they suppress, and this is my thesis, they suppress the very activity that they introduce by suppressing it as the activity of a being who is essentially an embodied agent in the world. If we can only know what we have made, which is what all this is about, some version of the maker's knowledge thesis, then what we need here is a more serious understanding of human beings as makers or determiners of the world. Hence the transition to a new form of consciousness has not one, but I think two aspects. The infinity of thought is that consciousness can only discover the grounds of the structure of identity and difference by examining itself. Consciousness must become self-consciousness. That move now seems easy. But second, that self-consciousness must be truly active, truly world-forming or determining, hence truly the work of an agent, that is, a being whose needs and desires lead it to act so as to determine the world. So the problem with synthetic forms of forms of synthesis is they're acts without desire. If they're acts without desire, then they lack the fundamental structure of agency. So there's something about them that is both an act and not an act. And Kant's way of saying that they're an act and not an act is bundle them all up into the world spontaneity. It happens. We do it. But in what sense do we do it intentionally? So what Hegel wants to say is this business of satisfaction. Knowledge must be fundamentally satisfying to agents. And therefore, it must be a true structure of agency at work in determining which categorical sets, what frames, what ideas we use for the sake of knowledge getting. If knowledge getting is an activity we do. Hence, the assumption in all this is simply that there can be no action without there being a spring of action. And the spring of an action must be at least minimally, starting at the most simplest level, a need or desire. Hence, to move to self-consciousness, which is where we're heading, is equally to move to a different relationship to the world, namely one in which the agent originally is related to this other by desiring it. So my simple thought is here, it's actually the problem in Kant is it's action without desire. And it's desire we need to get beyond the bad form of transcendental idealism and move to a conception of knowing that treats knowers as true agents. That's why Hegel talks about satisfaction. And hence, that funny passage about satisfaction is indeed that very phrase, the critique of Kant's version of the Copernican term, Hegel's account. Okay, that's what I wrote at 5 o'clock this morning. Questions? I guess we have a couple of minutes. Have I actually warned you out completely?
Yep, warned you out completely.
Okay, next week we go really. Next week we really do go to subconsciousness.
Because if you don't get it now, I can't do any better.
This is the best I can do with this stuff. And we'll do what we can next week.